Who's checking the checkers? How accurate is the house energy rating software, Accurate? G'day and welcome back to another episode of Homestyle Green. This is the podcast dedicated to inspiring people to make a better place to live. Back in 2003, the Australian government introduced home energy rating requirements for residential properties. And they provided through the CSIRO a piece of software called Accurate, which was energy modelling software. And one of the immediate concerns from industry was just how accurate and reliable was this software that was called Accurate. And Mark Dewsbury, who was studying architecture at the time at the University of Tasmania, set up a project to answer that very question. And I caught up with Dr. Mark Dewsbury recently while he was visiting Auckland on a trip with Professor Dr. Hartvik Kunzel, who we've had on the show before. They were over from Tasmania and gave us a presentation at the ProClimber Hub. So while he was there, I sat down with Mark and asked him how he got involved in design and architecture in the first place.
One of my first employers was Woolworths.
Yeah.
And as a trainee manager.
Mm-hmm.
And from that...
On the construction side?
I'm still design. I was originally just managing shops.
Yeah, right.
And then from there, because of a particular knack I had, end up in national store design.
Right.
And development.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, designing back then, we didn't have hooks as we know them today. We used to have pegboard and so I was designing hooks and design.
For products.
Designing shelves. And designing new concept stores.
Mm-hmm.
And amongst that whole mix of the new concept stores was how to reduce energy.
Yeah, which is huge.
Lighting systems. Yeah, mostly what I was involved with was lighting systems and for merchandising and one of the first shops we did, we actually went through and took out every fourth light and sales increased.
Really?
Went again to get another one in four lights.
Wow.
And sales increased. So the whole thing about getting this, the typical overly lit retail space is not good for business.
Interesting.
And then others, of course, brought in...
And this is pre-LED, I assume.
This is 1980...
Halogen?
85, 86.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and then things like, for example, the daylight tubes for fruit and veg, the red tubes for meat.
So tricks of the trade?
So from that... And that... So that was happening at that level because I was so involved with that. My partner and I were, Vicky more so than me, I can say, was very interested in low-cost alternative build.
Mm.
And so when I was in Newcastle in 88, she was very heavily involved with natural resource things and the Sandgate Wetlands Project and other projects
where
reinvigorating wetland zones and running education programs for those spaces. And parallel to that, there was the whole mud brick community and rammed earth community in those areas.
Right. Yeah.
So we're doing a lot of stuff in that. And that led to us designing and building a load-bearing mud brick house
in
New South Wales. In a place called Glen Innes, which is quite alpine. We've had minus 16 on our veranda.
Wow.
But it's only 4 hours from Brisbane. So that slide today about, this is Brisbane. Here's a to just really dispel. If you're on that coastal edge, where you really have the maritime influence, yes. But the moment you move away from that coastal edge, a lot of Australia gets very cold at night.
Yeah.
So.
As a builder of a mud brick house, were you an outlier?
Ooh. In terms of typical.
Yeah.
You're probably looking at 1% of housing being. It'd be less than 1% in terms of, in that time, was mud brick and rammed earth. If you had a site with clay soil, it was mud brick. If it was a site with sandy soil, it was rammed earth. Straw bale, so jumping ahead many years. And so would have been the very late 90s. Yeah, because mid-90s, we were still talking ram death and mud brick. So very late 90s, straw bale started to appear on the scene. And so we did a, in 2003, we did designed Tasmania's first load-bearing straw bale house.
In what year was it?
Not 2002.
Oh, right. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Going back to the mud brick, why did you do that?
Ah, so this is before climate change.
This is before we knew about it.
Before the public knew about climate change. Scientists knew about climate change. So the mud brick thing was about concerns for resource depletion.
Right.
And I guess that even back then there was discussions about, well, if we want to build a house, really it should come from the resources of place.
Mm-hmm.
And so so we had the clay from site was the mud bricks.
Yeah.
The timber was from trees on our property or very close to our property. The roofing, of course, the sheet metal had to come from somewhere else. But it was that whole thing, you know, we purchased a house lot of windows.
Right.
From a house.
Secondhand ones.
Secondhand ones. And they became, they've since been, we gradually rechanged them to double glazing. Because we still own the property. It's rented. And so, yeah, that was all happening. Kitchen cabinets were, I hand built them. Yeah,
so it was about resource.
So I understand, coming back to that, well, there's two parts to resources. One is, well, where they're coming from, what's that energy cost in that process? Mm. And the second thing is that, a bit like what Joe Lisbrick was saying yesterday, was that, you know, I can build a concrete building, it's going to last for 300 years. If I build a not concrete building and it only lasts for 20 years, well, is that sustainable?
Mm.
And I have similar dilemmas. I do a lot of research for timber and advice about timber structures. And I say, well, you know, if the hardwood tree took 60 years to grow, well, the building needs to last at least 60 years.
Yep.
But at the same time, the cladding needs to last 60 years. The chairs need to last 60 years.
Mm.
And if we're not, if any of these things aren't lasting 60 years, we're actually increasing our consumption and greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, which is very interesting in the context of here, where our materials are only required to last for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Cladding,
yes.
You know, that's the easily accessible stuff, is only required to
but if that's a weatherboard, even if it's softwood, it took 40 years for the tree to grow.
But I mean, so who's going to replace their weatherboards every 15 years? It's crazy. How did you go from managing Woolworths stores to being being an architect?
So a long pathway. So I was with Woolworths, did national store design. My partner didn't want to stay in Sydney, so we left Sydney, and that was the Newcastle link then. And so I worked for a regional chain as a fix-it manager.
Right.
Going around and improving sales at stores.
By turning lights off.
Yeah, and rearranging, the layouts were crap. Rearranging the stores. I could go into a store and within 12 weeks we'd doubled or tripled sales.
Wow. Valuable business.
Yeah, I used to get good bonuses.
Yeah.
And free groceries and a company car.
Nice.
So it was that for a while. And then with that job, we ended up in Glen Innes, which is the hometown of my partner. So it was the connection that happens there. And after, and that company I've been employed with was eventually bought by Coles, and with a very different support structure for staff, which I disagreed with.
Right.
So I left them, worked with a friend who was a surveyor for 3 months, walked tromping around the bush and doing surveying.
Yeah.
And because of my drawing experience, I could draw up
something. Right, right.
From there was a prison being redeveloped, so I went in as a civilian manager for the prison redevelopment.
Yeah.
From there across to TAFE, New South Wales, technical colleges, where I was a college administrator and then various other roles at a regional level, and then became the properties manager for, so there's 11 TAFE colleges, all new work, minor work, refurbishments.
Right. But all through this stage, you're not qualified as a...
I became a quite senior bureaucrat, and that included coordinating major projects in Sydney. And I got to the top of where I could go. So I got postgraduate management, because that was part of what the government said along the way, do this as well.
Yeah.
and for me to go into, for me to enter the state executive service back at that time, they wanted me to have both the postgraduate management and the industry experience I had, but also have engineering or architectural or something similar.
Right. Yeah. So they had experience, you didn't have a piece of paper.
Yeah. So I took 3 years leave without pay.
Wow.
And I went to Tasmania to study architecture.
Uh-huh.
And didn't leave.
Right, and still there.
Still there, yeah. So 21 years later, yes. Still
so
there.
That would have been, was that a degree?
Yes, I did the Bachelor of Architecture. So okay. At the time, back so when I was looking at the options back in 1995 and 1996, there was... I was very interested in the sustainable credentials of the courses.
Yeah, because you had that background and your own experience.
So I looked at the university at that point in time, the University of Newcastle, University of Canberra, and Tasmania, University of Tasmania, all had very strong credentials in that area.
Mm.
And now those three, I end up choosing Tasmania.
Yeah.
And so did the move to Tasmania, and did the first degree. So architecture, we do 2 degrees. You do a Bachelor of Design.
Yeah.
These days, you do a Master's as a second course. Back then, it was a double Bachelor.
Mm.
So I did the first Bachelor, the second Bachelor. Throughout the degree, the time of studying, the first 3 or 4 years, I was still a consultant to New South Wales Government.
Right.
So filling in, that was help to pay for uni.
Yeah.
And then for the tail end, I was getting projects in New South Wales and Tasmania. From people who were wanting their houses designed.
So mostly residential, jobs?
Yep. So when uni finished, we thought, well, we had a few jobs on the books.
Yeah, right.
We'll just keep going and see what happens.
Uh-huh.
And so our focus was the solar passive principles. So,
and was that the genesis of your practice?
Yeah, so 96, so from 1988... we had a design business,
mm-hmm.
and from 1996 onwards, it was more buildings than not buildings.
Is this Karawa?
Yeah, Karawa.
Karawa?
Yeah. So
that's still going?
Yes.
In the background?
Extremely part-time now.
Right.
The administrative load is associated with modern academia just seems to keep increasing. So it's become very challenging, extremely challenging.
So did you leave university or did you just stay there?
In terms of...
Did you go out to practice and then come back?
So I finished uni and then was full-time with the practice. And so we had an office in town and all those sorts of things.
Uh-huh.
Started
doing housing projects.
Yep. So we're doing... People. So all the housing projects were... So at the time in Australia, back in 2002, 2003. So in 2003, the first regulations came in regarding insulation.
Yeah.
And then they've increased since then. But even back then, we were doing, in today's terms, 8.5 to 9-star housing.
Right.
So zero
out of 10.
Yes.
Yeah, so right up there. Yeah. Were you marketing yourself as a sustainable designer?
Yes.
Or did you already have a name out because of the work you'd done in the past?
Yes, I guess you'd said that we were named, which is quite funny. So most of our work... I could put an ad in the telephone book, and that would get us nothing. Most of our clients admitted that they'd heard about us by word of mouth.
Right.
So
was it a case that you would get clients that were already interested in that? You weren't having to convince them of...
That's a good point. Yeah, when we had the office in town, it was really interesting because part of the thing you'd have to do is clients would come in or people come in, mm-hmm. and the first thing you'd be asking about, how did you find out about us?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. And so normally we always call it the meet and greet. And so part of that was to actually understand why they were coming to us.
Yep.
And I'd sent many people away.
Right.
Because, we were virtually what we'd been picked and they'd come and seen us rather than... And so when we start talking about, let's talk about health and the cost of building and
mm-hmm.
the quality of housing and those things. And you could, if they were just, switching off, we thought, look, you can go down the road and employ someone.
It's not our bag.
For a lot cheaper.
Yep.
Who will give you a much lesser quality house.
Right.
But that's what they were after.
Right.
We got burnt by one project where it was an engineer and he said all the right answers in terms of us thinking, yep, they want to go this path. About 4 months later, 5 months later, when we were full on into that project, what became evident was that his wife wanted a very low energy home that she could be comfortable in whilst her husband was at work.
Right.
But he didn't see.
Yeah.
Which was very interesting because considering he was an engineer. We've had many clients who've been engineers and have been very, very interested in how.
Interesting. So you were moulding your clientele by as much as who you rejected as a client as who you took on as a client.
Yes.
Right. And then creating a name for the company. And then how did you get back to university?
So because I was doing this whole zero energy thing and also I was one of the very early users of the software simulation.
Was it called Zero Energy at that
time? No, we just called it Solar Passive Design.
Yeah. Solar Passive Design,
So holding about
this. And you had that metric of aiming towards 8 and 9 stars
on that. Well, I guess the metric came later. That's interesting to think about that because in 2003, when the first energy efficiency regulations came in, it was just about, we need to have a metric.
Right.
In the background, since 1998, there had been this discussion at a governmental level and just developing the star rating system. Mm. CSIRO developed that metric. And like I guess all democratic things, it's a different, it's based on megajoules of energy per square meter for heating and cooling. And there's 16.
Based on the design, right?
Yes.
So it's not an as use.
No, rating. No, it's purely based on the design drawings or design information.
Yeah.
And so there's 69 different tables.
Yeah.
In terms of there's 69 different climate types.
Yeah, across Australia.
And different energy allowances. So, for example, Hobart at the moment for 6 stars is less than 200 megajoules per square metre because it's a heating-based climate,
mm-hmm.
whereas Broome, which is a cooling-based climate, is closer to 400. So
right. Mm. Does that total megajoules?
Yes, per square metre.
So heating and cooling load?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. But I guess that you can get great efficiency. It's much easier to insulate against cold than to... and also the efficiencies you get from your heating equipment.
Mm.
If you can put any high quality split system in, you're going to get a COP of about 2 to 3 operational versus testing.
Yes, or marketed.
And in a warm but a dry climate, yes, you can put a evaporative cooler in,
mm-hmm.
and they get a COP of about 10. But if you're in a hot and humid climate, it's a really energy intensive cool the air.
So you're creating a name for yourself?
So we did. Yeah, so
university rings up.
So Forest and Wood Products had put out a project regarding does the software that the government wants to use work?
Right. Good question.
For timber housing. And so
interesting. So the government had put out that we're going to start requiring this
star ratings,
and was that a reaction from the timber industry saying, "Hang on a minute"?
It was.
Are we going to be
disadvantaged
here? Can we check the validity of this?
Of the software, yeah.
Right.
So it was originally about a validation of software. The project team then included Robert Vale.
Yeah.
And we were talking with Housing Tasmania as a partner. So then it was moulded into, we want to validate the software, but let's actually make it a zero energy house at the same time.
Right.
So we spent that 6 months with a developer developing plans and wall systems. But these were fully autonomous houses. So we had on-site wastewater, on-site rainwater, on-site power.
Wow.
In an urban context.
Yeah.
And we spent 9 months on that project and designed those buildings. And all was looking good, and then for personal reasons the developer changed their mind.
Right.
So we did all this effort, and so as part of that also we designed the measuring systems. So in terms of how we're going to measure water flow, electricity flow, heat flow, all those things we designed as well. And then came back to the original question by the Tim Ministry about will this software work?
Mm.
So I then quickly turned around and designed 3 test buildings. What we call an unenclosed platform floor. So that's a building on poles.
Yep.
An enclosed platform floor, which is has the bricks going all the way to the ground,
yep.
but it's got a timber floor,
yep.
and then a concrete slab on ground floor.
Right. Yep.
And so Cookie designed them, got them approved by councils and university and everything else, and we built those. And then...
And were they test huts?
Test buildings, yep. So 6 metres by 6 metres.
So there were people living inside them?
No, because they're all... Like, we actually, yeah, good point. So people are a problem.
Yeah, it's a perfect building.
We can look at any research project and say human behaviour stuffs everything.
Right,
so,
right.
So, and so there's also discussion about do you put windows or not. I designed them so we could put windows in, but from when we built them and even to today, all we have is an access door because we're really limiting the variables.
Right.
We can say, look, that is a particle board floor and it's got a framing factor or whatever. Mm. So it's so many square metres of particle board, so many square metres of particle board in timber,
yep.
7 square metres of particle board and insulation.
Mm-hmm.
The same with the walls in terms of the framing ratios. So we can really fine-tune the thermal model.
Right.
With yeah. a little variables.
You're not overcomplicated.
Yeah. And to them, when you're testing things, you're able to better get an idea.
Mm.
When things don't, when you get a different answer, when the software has a different answer to reality,
yeah.
you can then actually drill down much easier to work out
yeah.
or
yeah.
what might be at fault. Or need improving. And, yeah, so we did those. And so for the year of 2007, we developed Australia's best high-quality data set of room temperature data.
Right.
And that worked quite well. In the background, another developer popped up, and we built three houses in Hobart. The developer was much less zero energy-minded.
Mm-hmm.
So we designed a four-star house, which was a code compliant house of the day, and 2 5-star houses.
Mm.
And so two of those buildings were timber platform floors, and one was a concrete slab on ground floor.
Yeah.
And a colleague of mine, Detlev Geard, he took on that project as his PhD, and I guided him through that. And yeah, so that's his merit. He's got lots of photos of me telling him what to do or showing him what to do, but it was his PhD.
So somewhere in there you did your PhD?
Yes. Yeah. So yeah. Yeah.
As
so,
part of the,
so the, yeah,
the validation so, project.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Now, yeah. What did you find?
Oh, I guess I can say that you know we found differences between what the Accurate software. I'll go back a step. So when we the software is a regulatory tool to compare two apples.
Yeah.
So and so
and design touch.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm.
Because we're trying to establish, does the software actually properly calculate the energy flows through a building?
Mm-hmm.
We had our own climate data, so we had the climate data of the location of
right.
buildings.
Right.
So we had our own climate files.
Yep.
We had, rather than just saying, oh, it's a plasterboard wall, well, I was mentioning before about the framing factor.
Yep.
So we had the framing factor for the walls, the framing factor for the ceiling, the framing factor for the... So we actually modified all the insulation values based on those known knowns.
Right.
And infiltration, we measured infiltration, so we had the blood, we had that data to inform the leakage in the building. So we had a range of what we call front end and back end inputs that yep. were not normal.
Right, because normally someone would just assume
right. There's the assumed values in the software.
Yeah, yeah.
And generally speaking, from a regulatory perspective, that's fine because yeah. what I do is say, if I have this house and I put more insulation in, is it going to be better or worse?
Sure.
So we did all that process, measured the buildings, had the simulation data, and the measured data was similar to the... I'll say it again. The simulated data was similar to the measured data.
Right. So the model was good.
It was good. This is what I'm saying, not the same as, because was similar enough that you could sit back and say, well, this is pretty good.
Right.
So
there's enough variation between, say, a 4-star and a 6-star.
Yeah, we'd have a cloud come over and it would drop the solar radiation and we'd see a drop in room temperature and we'd see a corresponding drop in the simulation temperature.
Right, right.
So there's enough of those. You know, sometimes it'd be out by half an hour, but
yep.
But in terms of doing an energy calculation from that, it's neither here nor there.
So the timber industry is happy?
They were, yeah. It was interesting because...
During that time, I guess, the software was being used anyway, wasn't it?
Yes,
Scheme had been rolled out
nationally. And sadly, and it's one of those quirks of regulatory frameworks, is that when five-star came into place in Australia,
as the requirement,
right, all these builders and developers had jumped onto doing concrete slabs.
Huh.
And I was extremely annoyed by that, because what it showed was a typical industry, what's the quickest way to get to a number?
Oh, okay. So is that just by
adding the thermal mass, they got five-star.
Really?
Now, the issue with me, what I was concerned about that was that from my experience with my own business, was that we had many, our best performing buildings might have been two pavilions or multiple pavilions, and the northern pavilion would be high mass because the solar passive and everything else. And the southern pavilions or southern half of the buildings would be lightweight, very well insulated. Because the only way you can heat the mass up in the back half of the building is through mechanical.
Yep.
And so
it's not getting any sunlight on that.
So I saw this big rush to doing concrete slabs to get 5 stars, which was just, you know, that got them 5 stars. But in 10 or 20 years' time, or 30 years' time, whatever it might be, that we need to make those houses 7 or 8 star houses due to climate change. We've got all this thermal mass in the wrong location.
Yeah, right.
So that's going to be a very difficult process.
Yeah, interesting. Jumping forward to today, you're still very involved in sustainability overall.
Yeah.
But has that morphed a little bit more into moisture control? Is it moisture control?
So if I think back to even the mud brick days, part of it was about health and how we're providing healthy buildings.
Yeah, right.
And so in the solar passive stuff, it's how you're providing healthy buildings that people can live in.
Yeah. You know, so the environmental sustainability is one part.
Also
people living healthily, livability.
So it's mixing those different aspects of sustainability. And so when we first flagged the back in 2006, when I first flagged the issues, because that sort of came out of the issues about looking at solar energy housing and looking at what was being found in Canada back then and in England, so we were seeing these issues popping up in other countries regarding poor indoor air quality issues due to low energy. And so we flagged a few things, one about ventilation rates, one about condensation. So we advertised our first PhD back in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, nicely, we had a few people from Germany apply, but sadly, none of them moved to Tasmania.
So,
and then it went to a black hole for a long time, sadly. And because coming back to fund, you know, universities require funding and having to wait till someone else jumped on board saying, yes, we want to give you money for 3 years for a PhD. In the background, there was a range of short projects for state government and federal government and industry about, is this a problem? And because we knew it was
happening. Moisture in general or air quality?
So I guess what the first markers were, the state government getting lots and lots of phone calls from early winter, so from March and April, people ringing about their new houses that had mould, or the new houses with the ceiling stripping, or the new houses where there were all sorts of excessive moisture events occurring.
And some of those images you showed today are staggering. And they're 3 month old and less than a year and already showing some pretty severe signs.
We call them the first winter houses.
Right.
And sometimes it's hard because if we get that phone call in that 3 months, we can go there and, we can say, look, you need to get the cutting off, you need to open the roof up,
be scary if you've just bought a house got condensation and mould and it's only 3 months old.
And who's at fault? The house is built to code. The house is designed to code.
Yep. So who is at fault?
Well,
Because that is...
And this is it's a very grey area. I could say personally that the designer and the builder are both at fault because as professionals... they should know about this.
Yeah.
But in reality, they've got no idea.
Yeah.
And there's no regulatory requirement until this year.
Yeah.
So there's been no need for them to even think about it.
Yeah.
And I guess a common...
I mean, it's very similar to our leaky building crisis, but in reverse.
We have a leaky building crisis too.
Right, right. But instead of water getting in from the outside because of a bunch of design issues, construction issues, concealing issues, it's... condensation from the inside.
I think part of it's because when the leaky building syndrome hit New Zealand, they thought everything was about water getting in.
Yeah.
But they soon learnt that, oh, no, some of it's about water getting in, but a lot of it's actually about water not getting out.
Well, I think we're only just realising that now. Because, and there have been cases where there's mould, there's condensation, and the assumption is, oh, my building's leaking.
Yes.
And then the surveyor or someone will come up and say, well, no, the cladding's fine, the roofing's fine. Mm. You're actually generating your own rainfall on the inside from condensation.
Yes.
So that awareness, I think, is quite new at the moment.
And I could say even in Australia it's mixed, because on one hand we've got the current apartment crisis, and they're saying that's about moisture ingress.
Yeah.
But many of the examples I've been shown over the last 3 or 4 years, 5 years, it's, you know, that it's actually excessive moisture in the building.
Yeah.
The concrete facade system is very vapor resistive.
Mm.
The paints are vapor resistive.
Mm-hmm.
There's inadequate ventilation. So all this water vapor is just building up inside the apartments.
Yeah.
And the bedrooms, which are a long way from a window, are all becoming extremely mouldy.
Yeah.
So that, whereas you get water cascading down the interior wall, well, that's a moisture ingress problem.
Yeah.
Mm.
One of the things that Australia and New Zealand have in common is that we're facing these issues kind of in parallel, but we're not the first people to face them. And you're benefiting right now from the likes of Hartwig, from Germany, from Fraunhofer, having a sabbatical. And someone asked a good question today at the seminar. How do you think the industry in Australia and New Zealand can best learn from overseas examples, or appreciate that we are not the first people to experience this problem?
One of the lucky things with being an academic is I get to read other people's mistakes and reports. So, an average person in the workplace is just wanting the quick answer.
Yes.
The first page of Google search.
Yeah.
And often that can be the wrong answer. One thing I became very aware of, even back when we were doing the soft passive stuff and the other stuff back in the early 2000s, was that the way you build a house in Canada is very different to how you build a house in Australia. The way you build a house in America is very different to the way you build a house in Australia or New Zealand.
If they're comparable climate zones,
very in different terms of latitude,
we do have different housing
stock. And Europe, Germany, for example, the majority of buildings in Germany are still solid masonry. So solid masonry has an amazing hydrothermal capacity for being a hydrothermal buffer.
Right.
Whereas a timber frame,
can suck up water and release it slowly.
Yes.
And what does that? So that buffers the internal environment to be more healthy.
Yeah. Whereas in a lightweight framed building, the timber is a hydrothermal buffer, but it's only a very small proportion.
And it's quite thin.
So really, you've got a lot more vapor being pushed in and out of the envelope compared to. I get even a double brick house where you've got 100 to 10 mils of clay brick on the inside, that acts as more of a better hydrothermal buffer than the timber. So we've got very different. And the other thing is that in many parts of Europe and Canada and America, the roof spaces are a part of that building.
Yes.
And so you've got very thin roof spaces and lots of discussion in all the regulations that continue to be refined about, well, do we call it a hot roof or a cold roof?
Right.
Meaning, do we have cool air ventilating it, or do we have it as a full sandwich system?
Yeah.
And they're they're also having lots of challenges regarding, is it working, isn't it working?
Right, right.
Whereas our construction, it's got the frame construction, which is a bit different, and then we've got the cold roof system, which is where the attic is unused and unconditioned.
So our insulation's lying flat above, resting on the ceiling, and then we've got this big cold space before we get to the roof tiles or iron. Whereas Europe would be sloped ceiling.
Yep, that's part of the living space that's conditioned.
Kind of like a livable attic.
So
there are some differences, for sure, in the materials we use, construction methodology, but I get the sense that the underlying issues, as in we've taken buildings that were never insulated in the first place, we've added insulation, now we've got this temperature and humidity gradient across the wall.
Yes.
That's common.
It is common.
Europe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever, North America 20 years ago.
Mm.
So the question still remains, how can we best catch up and learn from from those that have gone before
us? And that's where I guess, in terms of you're looking at those pathways and Oak Ridge have doing a lot of research, and some of their research has been successful, some of it's been unsuccessful. There's been things used in America which have actually caused more problems.
Yeah.
And they've had to backtrack on certain principles.
And which so, we've done here too. We've stuck foil in things and and vapor barriers, so we haven't let anything through, either in or out.
Yeah, I agree. And probably about 2015 or 2016, whenever it was. Mm-hmm. I guess I've known about Woofie for quite some time. Around 2015 or 2016, when I was talking to the people at Oak Ridge, and they were admitting to some recent failures or some recent issues, and and I said, "Oh, so what are you going to do about software now?" And they said, "Oh, we're going to use Woofie."
Uh-huh.
And so I thought, "Well, there's no point in pursuing these guys anymore."
Right, they're sold.
So I thought from then on, from then I've had a very slow email chat with Hartwig and Fraunhofer.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year, I thought, I need to push this. I need to take it to a new level. So last year I went to Munich for 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And spent a week and a half with Fraunhofer.
Yeah.
And half a week with Proclaimer.
Yeah.
And that was just to really say, look, you know, we need to take a big step, for want of better words, and look at, rather than looking at what's being done in terms of drawn terms, like drawing walls and drawing things, mm-hmm. from other countries, we need to simulate our wall systems in the appropriate transient hydrothermal software.
Right.
So that we can actually say, well, we can use our own climate piles. We can put in material properties relative that is very similar to our materials.
Yeah.
And develop local knowledge based on current best tools to advise government on regulatory change.
That's a great way of summarising it. In talking to the students you've got here now, it sounds like that's exactly what they're doing, is taking the best from overseas, the best practices, but localising it in terms of the data, material data, climate data, so that we're doing a bit of both. We're learning from the best and the experiences internationally, but making it relevant to our materials, our situation, and our products and our situation.
Yeah, and I think even the point that, you know, there was the talk yesterday where the discussions regarding the 1,300 mils of rainfall in Auckland and the temperature range in Auckland.
Yeah.
And you could say, oh, yes, we can compare that to Houston or Memphis, or it might be.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, the way they build buildings in Houston is very different to the way they build buildings in Auckland.
Yeah.
So having to think, no, we just can't copy and paste. We have to say, well, okay, yes, we have got this rainfall issue.
Right.
We do have this temperature range. And the other really important thing, is that, and I learned that back when we did the validation project, was that climate files are averages.
Yes.
And so engineers like averages. I'm a bit more critical. As a designer of buildings, I know that my building average is one thing, but the peaks and troughs is where my building has to really work hard.
Mm.
And so similar with the hydrothermal software, if we just use average data, we get a very flat result. If I actually use data where I've got those hot days and cold nights and hot days and cold nights, it's something the built fabric is having to work much harder at managing water vapor.
Yeah.
So we need to push those different boundaries about understanding what we're modelling and why we're modelling it and how we're modelling it.
Quite a lot going on. What's your current biggest challenge for the industry?
I would say I've got two or three different pathways at the moment. One is educating people, so, you know, going and giving talks at community events and different things about educating the people, you know, that mould is bad for you and those sort of things. And I'm doing that through rural health in terms of informing doctors and brochures for patients and those sort of things. So there's a whole inform the market about these issues from a health perspective. I run talks all the time for builders and architects and designers and engineers, trying to educate them. One of the concerns I have with that is that people often come to me and say, this is the third time I've been to one of your talks, it's great. So to some extent you're already talking to the converted there's an issue there. And the third, which is a much slower pathway, is my involvement in informing regulatory change.
Yeah.
And I guess I could, if I went back to why did I stay in academia, I could have gone back to my own private practice and probably done quite well.
Yeah.
But, you know, you'll be doing 5 or 6 projects a year.
Right.
Whereas the opportunity to be in academia and to initially to inform a whole class full of students every year.
So yeah, the next generation designers.
So you're saying you've got all these students who are hopefully remember little bits of what you said and take that on. But then at the research level, to be working with CSIRO and the likes of Hartwig from Fraunhofer and others about, well, look, you know, how do we inform regulatory change, which means every single new building will have this new requirement.
Yeah.
It's extremely slow in terms of, you think, of what can we do for 2019 and what can we do for 2022 and 2021. Yeah.
But you're turning a big ship around.
Yeah. So that's the...
That's what keeps you going, keeps you up in the morning.
Yeah, you swear some days, and other days you think, yes.
So you enjoy Tasmania?
Yes.
You stay there?
It's not good for career progression, but it's a lovely place to bring up a family.
No, but I guess to your previous point, these days you think you can make that influence the whole industry from wherever you are?
Yes.
Because, I mean, you can influence Canberra from Launceston.
Yes. Oh, we have lots of arguments, but like, oh, you know, Canberra doesn't get as cold as Tasmania. Well, actually gets colder than Tasmania.
Yeah.
So there's all those sorts of something, oh, you're down there. So there's lots of that you have to combat in terms of, you know, oh, you're from Tasmania.
Sure.
And so pulling back to, well, no, here's a weather chart and you're actually colder. There's lots of that. But yes, I do agree in terms of the modern world and how we use technology to share information and to push things forward.
Yeah. And that was Dr. Mark Dewsbury. He is a lecturer of architecture and design, specializing in sustainability. And he did his PhD studies in the validation and calibration of Accurate software in Australia. And he continues to be really interested in that field of validation, of modelling, and also indoor air quality, ventilation, moisture control, those types of things that can be answered by software like Woofy. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Love to get your thoughts and feedback. You can email me, matthew@homestylegreen.com. Head over to homestylegreen.com/200. This is episode 200, and you can find some show notes. And I'll link up some of the reports that and research that Mark has published and referred to during this interview. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget, you can click the big orange button if you would like to help support this show, the Patreon page that I've set up. All donations are muchly appreciated. Thank you very much for tuning in. Now go make a better place to live.